Hello, Marco Werman here. These are unprecedented times we're living in. I want to get on with the show, but first, let me be honest with you. The world needs you. 3 million Americans, that's how many of you listen to The World and are sharing your own deep interest in global events. It takes a lot to keep the world spinning, and we can't do it without you. We need you to be one of 1,000 people to donate $100 or more for the work we do. Donate $100 today or pledge to give $8.33 a month for 1 year. If you decide to be one of the 1,000, you'll receive a special invite to a virtual party with me and the team to thank you for your worldly contribution. Go now to theworld.org/give. And now, on to the show.
Voters in Chile went to the polls and decided overwhelmingly rip up the Chilean constitution and write one of the people by the people.
It was a very clear message by the population that they do not want legislators involved in making the constitution.
Also today, the risks of trusting hyper-connected technology from another country. Careful before you open that app.
Once you know that you're being surveilled, you change the way you behave. And personally, I don't really care who the surveillance is coming from. I think all of this is really bad.
And rising tension between France and Turkey. Some Turks in Europe worry about the heated rhetoric from Ankara.
At the end of today, I think it really harms the people living here.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Sudan and Israel are setting aside decades of animosity. The two countries are on the brink of normalizing relations. The announcement came from the Oval Office Friday, with President Trump presenting it as a foreign policy win for his administration. If the plan goes through, Sudan would become the third Arab nation to repair relations with Israel under the Trump administration. The UAE and Bahrain both officially recognized the Jewish state last month. The World's Halima Gikandi is on the line with us from Nairobi, Kenya, to talk about what this means. And Halima, this is a big announcement. Does it mean there is now peace between Sudan and Israel?
You're right. It is a big announcement. On Friday, President Trump spoke on the phone with Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as Sudan's civilian and military leaders, Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok on the civilian side, and then on the military side, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. And then they released a joint statement saying Sudan will normalize relations with Israel. Sudan and Israel, they weren't at war, but since the 60s, Sudan was a leader in Arab League policy against Israel that essentially could be defined as the three no's: no peace with Israel, no recognition of Israel, and no negotiations with Israel. But on Sunday, we heard Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu completely flip that old script. And he said, now Sudan is saying three yeses. And then he went on to thank President Donald Trump for the role he played leading up to this announcement.
What role did the U.S. play in this? I mean, how did this announcement even come to be?
From very early on this year, Sudan's military leaders, or at least one of them, met with Prime Minister Netanyahu in Uganda. And then later, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visited Sudan. And that's really where the pressure came from. It was from really the U.S. We started hearing reports that essentially the U.S. was connecting, removing Sudan from the state sponsor of terror list, which that process just started officially last week. And it's something Sudan really cares about. It connects it to its economic future. And we started to see that reports that that was being connected with now normalizing relations with Israel. Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, of course, has continued to say, well, no, those things are still separate and they should be separate. But having seen all of this essentially happen at the same time, that's hardly convincing.
What's been the reaction in Sudan to this announcement?
In recent days, we've seen some political parties in Sudan oppose normalizations. Others support it kind of to a degree. One person I spoke with recently is an academic in Khartoum. His name is Mohamed Saleh Mohamed Yassin, and he's also actually been working on peace negotiations within Sudan. And that's a quick reminder that Sudan is also working on peace within the country. And he sees normalizing with Israel as a good thing.
Sudan is becoming a part of the international community, an international family, and now it is starting to end its isolation
Of course, that's just one perspective. I also spoke with a gentleman named Mutasim Ali, and he was born in Darfur, but he actually has Israeli citizenship because he was one of thousands of Sudanese asylum seekers who have gone to Israel over the years. And one thing he reminded me was that there are still laws in Sudan that essentially criminalize Sudanese people who go to Israel. So for him, on a personal level, he's happy to see these steps towards normalization. But he also has some other concerns.
I don't want to see guys like Al-Burhan and Hemeti are the ones to determine the foreign policy, but also to determine the Sudanese fate.
Halima, who are Al-Burhan and Hemeti?
Two of the main leaders on the military side of Sudan's government. So we have to keep in mind that ever since the political revolution in Sudan last year that led to former dictator Omar al-Bashir being ousted, the current government in Sudan is still in a transitional phase, and it's ruled in part by the civilian side and military leaders. And it's actually the civilian side of the government, i.e. Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, that are supposed to be responsible for foreign policy. That said, it's really been the military side that has been leading this process of normalization, which has worried a lot of people.
So is there any chance a signed deal might not actually come out of this announcement?
Of course, that's always a possibility with any announcement. Both Israel and Sudan have said that negotiators representing both countries will meet within the next couple of weeks to discuss this further. That said, even though no formal deal is set in stone, Israel and the United States are both cheering this as a huge win, especially domestically. And to that point, on Friday, President Donald Trump even brought this up at a campaign rally in Florida as an example of him, you know, bringing peace to the Middle East. In the region.
The world's Halima Gikandi in Nairobi, Kenya. Thanks a lot, Halima.
Thank you.
Countries in Europe are seeing a spike in coronavirus infections. The continent reported more than 200,000 new cases yesterday. That's nearly half that day's global total. European governments are responding with new restrictions, big and small. In Germany, big Christmas markets aren't happening this year. In Italy, gyms, pools, and movie theaters are closing. In Spain, authorities are going further. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has declared a national state of emergency.
Se prohíbe la libertad de circulación de las personas desde las 23 horas de la noche.
The Prime Minister also announced a nationwide curfew, limiting movement between 11 at night and 6 in the morning.
Y la situación que vivimos es extrema.
Sanchez said the situation we're living in is extreme. He called it Spain's worst medical emergency in a century. In France, overnight curfews are being added to dozens of new areas. COVID-19 patients now occupy more than half of the country's intensive care units. Dr. Eric Combe, head of the Infections and Tropical Diseases Department at a Paris hospital, told the broadcaster France Info that the country needs to lock down again. He said France lost control of the situation a few weeks ago. While cases are spiking in Europe, as well as here in the United States, Brazil seems to be slowly getting a handle on the situation. But COVID-19 isn't Brazil's only health challenge. During the first 6 months of the year, more than 1 million people came down with dengue, chikungunya, malaria, or Zika. Families impacted by Zika have faced particular challenges during the pandemic. Michael Fox has the story from Brazil.
An adorable little girl in light blue fairy pajamas lies on the bed with her mother and laughs into the camera. Her mom playfully monologues as the child lifts her head and smiles, mouth open.
E assim, ó, pra quem tem preconceito, pra quem pensa que microcefalia é o fim, é não, olha. Olha a Tina aí, olha, tá vendo?
For those who are prejudiced, her mother says. For those who think that microcephaly is the end, it's not. Look at Tina there. The video was posted on Facebook 4 years ago. That was the tail end of the Zika outbreak that exploded across Latin America in 2015. It hit Brazil particularly hard. Thousands were diagnosed with the mosquito-borne virus. That year alone, nearly 3,000 babies were born with microcephaly. That's a Zika-induced birth defect, where a baby's head is smaller than normal. It carries with it a host of developmental disorders. The children have a hard time holding themselves up, moving, communicating, or even eating solid food. They also have respiratory issues. Germana Soares is the founder of UMAS, the Union of Mothers of Angels, an association of more than 400 mothers of children with microcephaly in the Brazilian state of Pernambuco, which was ground zero during the Zika outbreak.
Que nós temos índice altíssimo de mortes de crianças por infecção respiratória.
Germana says we have a very high number of deaths of children from respiratory infections. And we were all very concerned because COVID also acts in that area. In the beginning, I thought there would be a lot of deaths. The mothers stayed home and did their best to protect their families from COVID. Germana says that miraculously, only one child in her group died, and that baby already had a series of other health issues. But everyone's been impacted. Normally, most of these children visit speech, occupational, and physical therapists daily, but it was all suspended due to COVID-19.
Que inclusive até hoje, mais de 80% das terapias elas não retomaram.
Germana says that today, more than 80% of the therapies have still not started, particularly the ones run by the state. And this has really set the children back, because she says everything that had been achieved was thrown into the trash. That's Germana's son, Guilherme, singing along to the radio. He has a light case of microcephaly and is able to say some things, but according to his mom, without his speech therapist, he's now having a hard time. He's forgotten his colors. He's confusing his numbers. Most of his words are now garbled and hard to understand. Others are much worse off.
Como é, mamãe? Como é, cante? Você estava cantando. Não, mas eu tomei banho.
Jacqueline Vieira speaks to her son Daniel about his upcoming birthday. He's turning 5. She sent me this video, which she shot last week. Daniel is propped up on pillows. He wears a diaper. He's finishing a meal through a feeding tube connected to his stomach. His fists are closed, his arms tight and folded against his body. Jacqueline says COVID was very hard because Daniel was developing a lot and then he was shut inside for 7 months. So now he doesn't open his arms anymore. When you stretch out his legs, he cries. He got a lot worse. The mothers receive a monthly stipend of roughly $200 to care for their disabled children. The public therapists, when they're working, are run through Brazil's state universal healthcare system. But beyond that, the mothers say they've been left out to dry by the government. Ingrid G. Adriele is the mother of 4.5-year-old Emanuele. She says, 5 years since these children were born and nothing has changed. We don't have support for anything, and it just got worse under this pandemic. No one called to see how we were doing. They don't care about these children. Here's the thing. Zika is a virus that overwhelmingly plagues low-income communities with open sewers and poor sanitation, breeding grounds for Aedes aegypti, the mosquito that carries Zika, dengue, and chikungunya. The mothers blame the state for the lack of adequate housing and sanitation. Here's Germana, the founder of the Women's Association again.
Mulheres pretas, pobres, periféricas.
She says, we are women, black and poor, from the slums, who already lived in precarious situations. And with the arrival of these children with disabilities, which was an error of the Brazilian state and irresponsibility of public health, this made these women even more vulnerable than before. The mothers say society discriminates against them and their children. Some related tales that they were even blamed for getting infected, as if it was their fault. The pandemic made it worse. Teresa Lira is a doctor and a researcher at Fiocruz, Brazil's top public health research institute. She says these populations who already faced difficult circumstances were double victims, because on top of being victims from COVID-19 like all of society, they were also victims of social exclusion, which makes them even more vulnerable. Zika hasn't gone away. There were 580 new suspected cases over 3 months at the beginning of the year, which prompted Human Rights Watch to call on Brazilian authorities to improve sanitation and provide greater reproductive rights. A new strain of the Zika virus was discovered in June, causing concerns that another outbreak could be on the horizon. These mothers, like Ingrid here, playing with her daughter Emanuele, shine with a seemingly infinite well of love for their children, and they say they will fight for them no matter the cost, with or without the Brazilian state. For the world, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
The presidential election is top of mind, not just in the U.S., but also around the globe. Learn how the rest of the world is viewing the U.S. election. Our coverage is at theworld.org/2020election. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The coronavirus outbreak didn't stop millions of Chileans from heading to the polls on Sunday and voting overwhelmingly to scrap the country's old constitution. Sounds of celebration in the capital, Santiago, last night as voters decided to rip up the country's constitution that was drafted in 1980 during the military dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet. A new citizen-drafted constitution was a key demand of massive demonstrations that rocked the country last year. Fierce protests over rising inequality led many to question Chile's reputation as a stable and prosperous democracy. Claudia Heiss teaches at the University of Chile's Institute of Public Affairs. She says the vote was peaceful and orderly despite the pandemic.
The election was very well organized. We had all the sanitary provisions and measures. People waited in line outside of the polling places. So it was extremely safe.
Now, I want to get to the results, which were pretty amazing, 78% approval. Was the referendum expected to pass so overwhelmingly?
70% was what most of us expected. It's a very massive result and shows that the demand for replacing the constitution cannot be translated into left-right cleavages or into any kind of political party division.
Now, Chileans got to vote on whether they wanted a new constitution, and they voted overwhelmingly yes. And they also voted on who should draft it. Tell us more about how the new constitution will be designed.
Well, that was one of the big surprises of the vote. It was a very clear message by the population that they do not want legislators involved in making the constitution. They want a different kind of representatives to make the new constitution.
So because of how Chileans voted, it will be an elected committee or group that actually puts together the constitution?
Exactly. It will be an elected body of 155 members elected directly by the people in polls very similar to the electoral system of the House representatives.
Claudia, many Chileans have enjoyed some level of prosperity in recent decades, especially compared to many of their neighbors. And those who voted no to the referendum say that prosperity is in part because the current constitution protects property rights and a free market. Do they have a point?
Poverty decreased very much in the last three decades, but the prosperity occurred within a frame of extreme inequality. More than 70% of the people in Chile are poor, according to World Bank standards. The rich group is only 3%. So really, we have a very, very unequal country, and most people are extremely vulnerable to shifts in growth. Growth has not benefited most of the population, and the system is seen as extremely unequal and extremely abusive. It's a system that always gives preference to the rights of property and free entrepreneurship when those rights clash against public goods like the protection of the environment or the protection of health and other public rights.
It's interesting because what you're talking about is very much a theme in American politics, growing inequality, even when the stock market's doing great. So that's an interesting parallel.
I think we're dealing with similar problems. Your political system has also created an increasing concentration of wealth and increasing inequality. And it's a puzzle to me why Americans are not more angry with their political elites with regard to the lack of protection in healthcare or education are extremely unequal. And I think as more people become vulnerable economically, they start demanding more social protection.
Claudia Heiss teaches at the University of Chile's Institute of Public Affairs. She's been speaking to us from Santiago. Claudia, thanks so much. It's very interesting.
Thank you very much.
France recalled its ambassador to Turkey over the weekend. It's the latest move in a growing rift between the two nations. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is blasting Western Europe over what he calls rising Islamophobia. And he's now joining regional calls for a boycott of French products. Dori Buscarin has our story from Istanbul.
A video circulating on Twitter purports to show two men at a grocery store in Jordan filling carts with French cheese and butter, removing them from the shelf. This morning, a pro-government Turkish daily published lists of French brands to show their readers what to avoid while shopping. By the afternoon, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was urging his citizens to stop buying products made in France.
Sakın Fransız markalara asla iltifat etmeyin. Bunları satın almayın.
This latest rift between the two NATO allies started with the gruesome murder of French schoolteacher Samuel Paty. Paty, a history teacher, showed cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in his class about freedom of speech. These depictions, which are deeply offensive to Muslims, were originally published by the satirical French magazine Charlie Hebdo, later the target of a 2015 massacre that killed 12. Paty was followed home after school and beheaded by an 18-year-old man born in Russia to Chechen parents.
Samuel Paty est devenu vendredi le visage de la République.
At Paty's funeral, French President Emmanuel Macron said Samuel Paty had become the face of the Republic, that his country would defend the freedoms that Paty taught and hold secularism high, that they would not give up caricatures or drawings even if others retreat.
Nous continuerons, professeur.
French officials have ordered investigations into Muslim organizations and the dissolution of a pro-Palestine group in France, which officials claim are leading efforts to foment violence. It is this crackdown that has drawn the ire of Ankara. Erdogan quipped that Macron didn't understand religious freedom and needed mental health treatment. France then recalled its ambassador to Turkey the next day. Now, a boycott of French goods is underway.
I think that harsh reaction is kind of like towards instrumentalizing Islam to score political gains.
Sinem Adar is a Turkish political analyst at the Center for Applied Turkey Studies in Berlin. She says Erdogan wants to position himself as a leader in the Muslim world, and advertising himself as a defender against Western Islamophobia is an effective way to do it.
Like what is fascinating in a negative way is that there was little coverage in the Turkish press about what happened.
The beheading got very little coverage. Macron's condemnation of Islamic violence did. To the point, Adar says, that Turkish papers suggested that the crime itself was staged by the French government as a pretext for going after Muslims. It is true that Islamophobia is rising in France and other parts of the West. Hate crimes are increasing, especially against women who wear headscarves and other types of coverings to mark their faith. But polarizing rhetoric like Erdogan's, Adar says, can backfire on Muslims living in Europe.
The ways in which the Turkish government has been engaging with, interacting with the Turkish diaspora and trying to mobilize them and instrumentalize them, at the end of the day, I think really harms the people living here.
Europeans see Erdogan's rhetoric as alarming, she says, forcing Muslims in Europe to choose, support an increasingly conservative view of Islam espoused by the region's leaders, or assimilate into European-style secularism. For many, that's an impossible choice. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin in Istanbul.
You're with The World.
A reminder to our listeners, The World is free for anyone, whether we're on air, on demand, or on the web. It's always been our goal to produce human-centered journalism to connect Americans with people and events beyond our borders. Help us keep the show accessible to everybody around the globe by donating $100 or more. That's $8.33 a month. If you help us make our goal, you'll get an invite to a virtual party with some of the incredible people who make this show possible. Go to theworld.org/give or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. Now back to the show.
The African nation of Mali is dealing with a pandemic and a military coup, and yet...
In a difficult moment, people need good message to calm down and to feel good.
Musician Alu Toure is keeping it positive, and Belarusian protesters step up the pressure to get rid of their president. That's coming up on The World. I'm I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. China's economic transformation over the past two decades has had huge reverberations across the globe. We've been examining the impacts all fall through a reporting project called On China's New Silk Road. China's economic ambition started with factories, making the world's clothes and toys. Then China moved into becoming a world leader in cutting-edge technologies. The telecommunications giant Huawei is a great example. Today, reporter Mary Kay Magstad focuses on that, China's digital power play.
5G, short for the fifth generation of telecommunications systems, is just beginning to roll out around the world. Compared to the current 4G systems, it'll transmit much more data, much faster, with more capacity and less latency. It'll be able to power the Internet of Things, communicating with your smart thermostat, smart appliances, perhaps with your driverless electric car. But since 2012, the U.S. government has told U.S. companies to avoid Huawei equipment in general because of security concerns. These days, that goes especially for Huawei's 5G, because of everything else that will be built on top of that platform. The Trump administration and President Trump himself have been urging U.S. allies in Latin America and around the world to avoid Huawei, too.
We convinced many countries, and I did this myself for the most part, not to use Huawei because we think it's an unsafe security risk. It's a big security risk. I talked many countries out of using it. If they want to do business with us, they can't use it.
One concern is that Huawei equipment itself may have vulnerabilities or backdoors that allow Chinese state security to access user data, as some U.S. equipment has been discovered to have, sometimes put there on foreign exports by the National Security Agency, or NSA. Huawei denies having backdoors. Whether it does or not, a Chinese law passed in 2017 says Chinese citizens and organizations, including companies, must help Chinese intelligence organs if they ask for help.
So in other words, if you're using the Chinese technology, your data is not just in those private companies' hands, such as Google or Apple. Your data is essentially at the hands of Chinese Communist Party.
This is Xiao Chang. He's a native of Beijing, now at the University of California at Berkeley's School of Information. He directs its Counterpower Lab, an interdisciplinary research group that focuses on digital rights and internet freedom.
The Chinese Party state, when they have the access of those data and with the technology behind it, they can use it for its own political, economic, security, strategic benefits, which not necessarily at the benefit of the users of these country and governments.
We have been open to be analyzed, to be tested, to be reviewed, that is not a situation that we need to discuss.
This is Adriana Marino, who at the time she's speaking here was head of Huawei Latin America's marketing and communications for businesses, based in Huawei's regional headquarters in Mexico City. Marino insisted when we talked that Huawei equipment and networks are secure.
Because, of course, security is one of the most important things that we have in all the programs that we run and all the products and services that we give.
Huawei does not share any of its data with the Chinese government?
No, we don't.
You're saying Huawei does not share any of its data with the Chinese government?
I'm saying that we don't share information with the Chinese government yet.
Customer data, consumer data?
Yes, correct.
Because there's a law that passed in China that said that if the Chinese government asks, companies have to do it.
I think that all those type of informations are a lot of speculations.
Xiao Chang doesn't buy that.
You will never see in China Huawei to say, oh, we don't provide this data. And they may publicly saying that. In the reality, they actually have the backdoor API in their database being built, directly being accessed by the Chinese state intelligence, by the Chinese military intelligence. They are so entangled together, it's more than just a contractual use between the two parties. Right? It's a lack of the line.
And he says that's not just true for Huawei.
In China, the issue is this authoritarian state, this autocratic system, is very, very opaque. It's not transparent. You don't know what technology are actually being developed and used and what a link between the militaries and those Chinese tech companies. What we do know is that none of them are independent from the party control.
The form of generalized surveillance and political repression that most concerns me is the pervasive surveillance of WeChat, which is the chat and everything else app that pretty much all Chinese people who use smartphones are going to be using.
This is Graham Webster.
I'm a research scholar and I edit the DigiChina project at the Stanford Cyber Policy Center.
And he lived in China for a few years, at a time when many people outside of China still thought the internet and tech could open China up. China's Communist Party was never keen on that idea. And under President Xi Jinping, it's doubled down on control.
You know, it used to be that you could have text messages or just hang out in restaurants or on the street corner and have relatively open conversations. And now so much happens through WeChat, really constantly. It's like a lot of other places in the world where people are staring at their smartphones all the time now instead of talking to each other. And that stuff is surveilled and it's censored and it's done in a way where there is substantial targeting of people who might discuss something that is especially of concern to the government. But it's more about the deterrent effect. People are afraid to talk about sensitive issues because they might get detected and they might get targeted.
But the U.S., Israel, and some European countries also sell surveillance equipment, and some would say it's just business. Some also do their own surveillance at home and abroad. Edward Snowden's 2013 revelations of just how much surveillance the United States had been doing, including on allies like German leader Angela Merkel, still stings in Germany.
I think Snowden showed us how the innocence of the belief in the free internet that was facilitating more openness, more transparency, more democracy was basically not there anymore.
Anne Roth is a policy advisor for a German parliamentary group called The Left.
My point of view in this is that any kind of mass surveillance happening in communications infrastructure is very bad for any type of democracy, because once you know that you're being surveilled, you change the way you behave, you change the way you talk. And personally, I don't really care who the surveillance is coming from. I think all of this is really bad.
That said, some Europeans were left feeling after the Snowden revelations that if both the U.S. and China could spy through their telecommunications networks, why not just go with the one that was cheapest? And yet, European attitudes toward Huawei and Chinese tech are changing. Whether because of U.S. pressure or because of their own review of risks, a growing number of European countries, the U.K., France, Germany, Belgium, and Italy among them, have chosen partners other than Huawei for their 5G networks or are considering that step. Several are also phasing out existing Huawei equipment. In Italy's business capital, Milan, one European suggests a pragmatic reason why it's in Europe's interests not to use Huawei 5G.
My name is Stefano Zanero. I'm an associate professor at Politecnico di Milano, which is Italy's largest university of engineering. We have 42,000 students, and according to some rankings, we are university number 16 in the world for engineering.
We're talking in a basement lab with tangerine and lemon yellow walls and with Legos in front of us and a foosball table in the next room. Very Silicon Valley. Stefano actually takes his top students there and to DEF CON Capture the Flag, where they compete in white hat hacking. That is, they attack computer networks to see if their defenses hold up as a way of helping those systems improve their defenses. Stefano says honing skills like these is crucial for Europe's tech future. So is fostering the know-how to build 5G networks and all that will be built on top of them.
Now, the choice of who you ask to build the 5G network is important because whoever gets the more contracts will have more resources to do research. So in 10 years, we will be building the 6G network. If we give a lot of contracts for 5G networks to a single player, there's going to be a single player able to build the next generation network.
That alone, he says, is a good reason to support the two European countries doing 5G, Ericsson in Sweden and Nokia in Finland. So is the fact that whoever controls a country's strategic infrastructure has leverage over the client and could perhaps say, we're not going to do maintenance. We're not going to give you any more spare parts. And then there's this.
Cultural elements are embedded in the way the technology is built. For a Chinese engineer, the concept of building, for instance, a way for a legitimate authority to snoop into a conversation, I think is way less of an ethical problem or of a mental problem than for an engineer in the US. In particular in the US, I think most citizens feel very strongly about defending their First Amendment rights. They feel so strongly about it that it is the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, right? It's kind of an important deal.
Yeah, people fought and died for this.
Right. And the same happened in Italy. The Italian Constitution says exactly the same thing as the First Amendment says. It protects the right of people to express their opinion, in particular if their opinion is critical of the government. So that's the value we share. And that value, in some ways, ends up being built in the technology we build. And the Chinese applications, you can bet on it, express their own cultural values.
From the perspective of the U.S. military, given that the U.S. and China, and now the European Union and China, are systemic rivals, why help China catch up on strategic capabilities any more quickly than it's already doing?
Where China is already ahead, you see a lot of important technologies on the left where China already has the lead.
This is Michael Brown, director of the U.S. Defense Department's Defense Innovation Unit. He's speaking at a virtual Stanford Hoover Institution conference on digital authoritarianism. His slide shows China ahead in facial recognition software, cryptocurrency, small drones, electric batteries and electric vehicles, solar energy, quantum communications, which can ensure encrypted communications for the user while cracking everyone else's encryption, and 5G.
Here's where we were as a country, asleep at the switch. Over time, we've let our key telecommunications equipment suppliers leave the United States. And so there, you could argue, we're already pretty far behind, and we either need to be neutralizing China's advantage with something like the Open Radio Access Network, which is being promoted now, how you virtualize 5G, so our software strengths come into play, or we got to leapfrog them and go into 6G.
This matters not just for ease of using the internet, but also for strategic reasons. Mike Brown said in his talk that of eight key technologies China is developing for military use, seven are commercial technologies. Mike Brown says the U.S. government urgently needs to do more of that kind of investment, the kind that once sent men to the moon.
We need to really imagine launching or ushering in a new era of technological achievement. And that happens when we combine the strengths of government-set moonshots, all the strengths of academia, and government money flowing through those systems to make sure that we can realize those goals.
That could start with Congress being more willing to allocate money for basic research. But another theme at this conference was that the United States needs to work more closely with its allies and set a better example of embedding democratic values in how tech and all things digital are regulated. Graham Webster from the DigiChina Project at Stanford's Cyber Policy Center couldn't agree more.
I think if the U.S. companies, much to their chagrin, are forced to develop adaptations to their products that really consider and ensure democratic integrity and really respect privacy, freedom of expression, and in a fairly costly way, I'm sure, reconfigure their business model so that the whole thing isn't depending on people paying to manipulate your behavior through advertising, then these could be some pretty darn compelling products around the world, right? If there's a whole technological ecosystem that is more respecting of freedoms and privacy and data security, then that would contrast with the Chinese offerings, which are built for surveillance and manipulation and, frankly, for lower cost.
Meanwhile, what the Trump administration has done is make it much harder for Huawei to get semiconductors, the chips that drive our digital world. China does not yet have the know-how nor the sophisticated fabrication plants to make these. Most are made in the United States, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, and the Netherlands.
And basically, all of the top semiconductors now are designed using software that can't be regulated by the U.S. government. So in the case of someone like Huawei, who's been targeted by the U.S. government for many years, if they are completely cut off from the most advanced semiconductors, that could slow their progress in various types of applications all over the map, from the cell phones that they sell with the really good cameras to the 5G infrastructure that the U.S. government really wants to prevent from being widely adopted around the world.
Which might be a U.S. advantage in the short term, but in the longer term, Graham says, that could lead to a splintered internet.
The Chinese government has been determined to build a more independent capacity in things like semiconductors for a long time. Now, there's absolutely no reason for them to back off on that. Now there's reason to go faster and faster and to just make all efforts to catch up, because the U.S. has demonstrated that it's willing to use this core technology as leverage or as a way to undermine crucial Chinese companies.
One school of thought is, once China starts breaking away and creating a separate internet with separate standards and norms, the argument goes, it'll bifurcate the world, with the U.S. and its allies on one side, and on the other, authoritarian states, sure, but also developing countries that perhaps could only afford to buy Chinese technology and not the more expensive stuff, especially if the quality is roughly comparable. And that argument says it would be hard, if not impossible, to put the splintered internet back together again. China's goals are clear. With momentum on its side from hundreds of billions of dollars spent over the past two decades to increase innovation and build up expertise in cutting-edge technologies. Even without its great global ambition, China would have incentives to invest in a high-tech future. Its economic growth is slowing, its population is aging, and China's tech industry has been an effective engine driving China's economic growth over the past decade. The vision is for that to continue, as China's digital Silk Road rolls out around the world, offering high quality and value for money, if not always the values embedded in that technology that all those on the receiving end might choose.
Mary Kay Magstad reporting for the project on China's New Silk Road, a podcast about China's Belt and Road Initiative from the Global Reporting Center. Thanks to Melissa Chan for her reporting on this story. You're listening to The World. Protesters in Belarus cast an ultimatum. President Alexander Lukashenko must step down by midnight last night or risk a nationwide strike. Thousands marched in the streets today, chanting, "We are the power." They say that Belarus's August presidential election was a sham. For his part, President Lukashenko continues to ignore them. Alla Pigalskaya is a freelance designer in the Belarusian capital, Minsk, and is taking part in today's strike.
Today is a very important day for us, and we hope that quite many people who support the general message of this ultimatum will go on strike. And today, from the very morning, we had information about quite many factories going on strike, but there were immediate brutal detention right there.
You mentioned the factory workers going on strike. How important is it that state workers are taking part in this nationwide strike?
Usually, Lukashenko is pretending to support simple people, simple workers. And this strike from state-owned factories is important because these people, they don't want anymore to tolerate all this violence.
Alla, does it feel like the nation of Belarus is on strike? Describe the scene for us.
If you look into the list of all those businesses, factories on strike, it's quite a long and impressive list. But when you are walking through the city, quite many shops, cafes are open and working. As we see, state is applying all the means they had, the pressure on private business and on all those who work in the state-owned factory. So I think that it's the beginning of the strike rather than the, you know, culmination or the only day of the strike.
Why are you striking today?
I'm striking because I really unhappy about the general situation in Belarus, all the violence we faced during the 26 years of Lukashenko dictatorship, and particularly these last 2 months. There is no law anymore. Law doesn't work anymore in our country, and anybody can feel safe. As to me, I don't feel safe anymore in my country, in my flat. And we joke that people are afraid of buses on the street because riot police use particular kind of buses. And people recognize it immediately on the street. Hmm. You know, it's very particular feeling when you have these people who can do anything they want.
Ala, it's noon on the East Coast here in the U.S. as we're talking right now. I understand you're planning to join a protest today, but don't know yet when or where it is. Why is that?
The only means for communication, we have social network, which are also accessible for these special services who then arrange detention of those who participate in protests. So that's our reality, and the only possibility to have this time when we can arrange some protests and not being detained.
Ala Pigalskaya is a freelance designer in Minsk, speaking about a nationwide strike that's taking place in Belarus. Thanks a lot, Ala.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The African nation of Mali is no stranger to unrest. For the past several years, rebels and extremist groups have tried to destabilize the government there. Then earlier this year, a military coup forced the government to resign. Musician Aliou Touré recently offered this assessment of his country.
There is nobody who can tell you how stable is Mali right now. It's kind of like a ping pong ball table, you know. It's kind of like that. So we're just waiting for the end of the game.
Yet despite the uncertainty in Mali, Aliou Touré and his band remain optimistic. Optimistic about the next generation of young Malians and that the world will pull through the pandemic. It may be a strange time for the Songhai Blues to release an album called Optimisme, but for Aliou Touré, the timing couldn't be better.
That name is very important for us because it's a word that humanity needs right now. Everyone needs to be optimistic right now. We all know what's going on in this world now. People are getting worried. The world is almost, everyone is almost down and down. So the best way to go through that situation for us is to be optimistic. In a difficult moment, also, people need music to feel better. In a difficult moment, hard moment, people need good message to calm down, to keep their self-control, and to feel good. We got fans all over the world who need to hear about Songhai Blues, even behind the stage, even without the stage. So I think we got internet, we got many, many possibilities to send them that message and that love and that vibes through many, many ways apart from the stage.
Of course, we miss the stage, we miss touring, but music is still around, which is the most important link between us and the fans. And we're going to keep doing it anyhow, even if we are stuck in Mali. It's important for us to keep that link between us and the rest of the world.
Aliou Touré of the Malian band Songhoi Blues. Their new album is called Optimisme. And that'll do it for today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman is back in the host chair tomorrow.